The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Fred Woodward from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from the Week magazine, the best of the U.S. and international media each week. The Triangle Radio Reading Service thanks Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's Reading of the Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. And we are reading this week from the February 2nd, 2018 issue of the Week magazine. Looking at the cover drawing, this week shows the traditional Republican elephant and the Democratic donkey. The Republican, they both have boxing gloves on. The elephant's got the red ones. The donkey's got the blue ones. They're baring their teeth and look like they've been fighting at it. They're on either side of railroad track, and just behind them on the railroad track, sitting in two chairs tied together, look like a couple of Latino children, probably representing the Dreamers. And then off in the distance is a train coming down the track. So the title is A Real Cliffhanger. Is compromise possible in the partisan battle over Dreamers, the wall, and immigration? And that, in fact, is our first main story, the battle over Dreamers and Trump's wall. What happened? The impasse between Republicans and Democrats over immigration will enter a new phase next week when the White House offers a legislative framework for a compromise that officials say will provide permanent legal status to Dreamers in exchange for securing the border and ending extended family chain migration. Last week, the immigration battle briefly led to a government shutdown. It ended when Democrats agreed to a new temporary funding bill in return for Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell's promise to address the fate of the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals program within 3 weeks. President Trump canceled DACA, created by President Obama back in September. It exempts from deportation 700,000 immigrants who were illegally brought to the U.S. as children. Trump gave Congress until March to decide whether to make it permanent through legislation. Before the shutdown, Trump rejected a bipartisan compromise forged by Senators Richard Durbin and Lindsey Graham. It would have given legal status to Dreamers in exchange for some funding for the wall and changes to chain migration rules concerning immigrants' families. Immigration hardliners, including the presidential advisor Stephen Miller, say they want $18 billion to fund the border wall, not the $1.6 billion Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer said last week he would accept in a deal. If there is no wall, Trump said in a tweet, there is no DACA. The three-day shutdown, the first in history with one party controlling both Congress and the White House, began after Senate Democrats blocked a spending bill that didn't address DACA. The Democrats' liberal base accused Schumer of surrendering when he agreed to the stopgap funding measure. But he noted that it included a provision to fund the popular Children's Health Insurance Program, CHIP, for 6 years. While this procedure will not satisfy everyone, said Schumer, it is a way forward. What the editorial said. Last week's shutdown belongs in the pantheon of futile and stupid gestures, said the Wall Street Journal. Negotiations to legalize Dreamers, a broadly popular move backed by both parties, were already underway. But Schumer wanted to please his progressive base by voting to shut down the government in a show of protecting the Dreamers. And so did Senate Democrats, laying the groundwork for a 2020 presidential run. But when 10 Democratic senators running for re-election this year in states Trump won in 2016... started feeling heat for the shutdown, Schumer bailed out and called retreat a victory. Democrats have little to show for their efforts, said the Los Angeles Times. McConnell has broken promises before, including ones made to Republican lawmakers, and there's no guarantee House Speaker Paul Ryan will even schedule a vote on any compromise bill passed by the Senate because of the hardline demands of the House's far-right Freedom Caucus. But Schumer had little leverage, and a prolonged shutdown might have poisoned the public support for DACA. What a pity that both sides are willing to use the Dreamers as pawns in a larger partisan battle. The one positive from all this, said the Washington Post, is that the stopgap bill came because a bipartisan group of 25 senators spent the weekend talking instead of excoriating one another. Led by Senator Susan Collins, this broad middle should no longer wait for direction from a chaotic White House or spineless congressional leadership. What the columnist said. Democrats lost their nerve, said Michelle Goldberg in the New York Times. They had real leverage, with Trump fearing he'd have to make his State of the Union speech next week in the midst of a government shutdown. Yet rather than waiting to see if Republicans would blink, Schumer backed down, selling out a base whose passion and energy he'll desperately need in November's midterms. Actually, Schumer was foolish to have taken a shutdown stance in the first place, said Rich Lowry in NationalReview.com. Holding the government hostage over a partisan policy issue is never a winning strategy. Normally, among the shrewdest operators in national politics, the New York senator clearly succumbed to the siren song of the anti-Trump resistance. Schumer is actually handling this very cannily, said John Cassidy in NewYorker.com. Republicans can no longer use funding for CHIP as leverage in the deal. And if a bipartisan group of senators does pass a bill, the White House will be under enormous pressure to declare victory and call on the House Republicans to fall in line. It's unfortunate Trump is so wedded to his wall, said Jonah Goldberg in NationalReview.com. Democrats are willing to partially fund it because they know that even under the best circumstances, it will take years to build a wall, and that if they take back the House in 2018, the whole thing becomes a white elephant. Serious immigration restrictions would much rather see mandatory E-Verify, a program requiring employers to check on job seekers' immigration status. If illegal immigrants can't get jobs, they'll stop overstaying their visas and crossing the border. E-Verify would be far cheaper than any wall and more effective. What next? The president no doubt would see a bipartisan agreement on immigration as a big win, said Stephen Collinson in CNN.com. But agreeing to anything that hardline GOP lawmakers would call amnesty for Dreamers, such as giving them a path to citizenship, would infuriate his base, which Trump is loath to do because of his record low approval ratings. Furthermore, the president appears to be under the sway of two immigration hardliners in the White House, senior advisor Stephen Miller and chief of staff John Kelly. Both men were reportedly instrumental in steering Trump away from his impulse to cut a deal with the Democrats, and they will fight any deal they view as insufficiently tough. As long as Miller is in the room, says GOP strategist Alex Conant, it is highly unlikely there is going to be any sort of agreement. Our controversy of the week, titled Trump, Beneath the Chaos, A Year of Kept Promises. We know what the media thinks, said Christopher Buskirk in USAtoday.com. But by any objective measure of personal and national prosperity, the nation is better off than it was a year ago when Donald Trump was sworn in as our 45th president. While his critics spent the year obsessing about phony Russian scandals, the White House intrigue, and the president's Twitter feed, Trump and his all-star cabinet were lowering taxes, filling the federal courts with constitutionalists, and cracking down on illegal immigration. The numbers impress across the board, said DeRoy Murdoch in NationalReview.com. The Dow Jones has soared some 6,000 points, and unemployment fell to 4.1%, the lowest rate since 2001. Deep cuts to the corporate tax rate and the repeal of some 1,500 absurd and obtrusive regulations on business have unleashed rampant economic growth, whose effects on salaries and workers are only just starting to be felt. To any honest observer, Trump has over-delivered on all expectations. Take off your blinders, said Tom Nichols in WashingtonPost.com. Yes, Trump has ushered in some policy changes that are pretty standard fare for a Republican White House, and his own ineptitude and his coterie of supervising generals have blocked him from indulging his craziest impulses. None of that compensates for the corrosive daily damage Trump has inflicted on the nation and the moral health of the Republican Party. My fellow conservatives once believed in fiscal prudence, civility, and the importance of character. In only a year, Trump has trained them to support accused child molesters for office, blithely applaud the addition of $1 trillion in debt, downplay Russia's outrageous election interference, and even shrug off Trump's own alleged payoff to porn stars. Meanwhile, with his unhinged tweeting, his overt racism, his crude bullying of aides and critics, and his disdain of our foreign allies, Trump has deprived the presidency of its majesty, its gravity, and its ability to inspire. Trump's first year has been an unremitting parade of disgraces that he doesn't even recognize as mistakes, said Sean Wilentz in NYTimes.com. That portends a very unhappy ending. Trump is certainly not normal, said Molly Hemingway in WashingtonPost.com. But sometimes that's a plus. Three previous presidents had promised to recognize Jerusalem as Israel's capital, but Trump was the only one who had the guts to do it. He also withdrew the U.S. from the ineffective and economically ruinous Paris Climate Accord, and suspended aid to Pakistan until it stops harboring terrorists. I don't much care for Trump's childish rhetorical style, but as a conservative looking only at his policy record, I'm elated. This is how the right loses its soul, said Jennifer Rubin, also in WashingtonPost.com. As long as Trump delivers policy nuggets, formerly principled conservatives will dismiss his constant lying, attacks on democratic norms and institutions, and undisguised authoritarian yearnings as merely unfortunate matters of style. The GOP's abject surrender to Trump is the most alarming development of his first year, said Jonathan Chait in NYMag.com. House Republicans are now running a counter-investigation of the FBI, while Fox News talking heads are calling for a purge of law enforcement officials who don't support our president. That doesn't sound like America. So far, the checks on Trump's power have held up. Will they hold up for the duration? That will be determined by a political fight of still undetermined outcome. It was a good week for secularism, with new research indicating that 0% of Icelandic people under the age of 25 believe the Bible's account of the Earth's creation. Icelandic belief in elves, meanwhile, remains stable, above 50% in the most recent surveys. It was a good week for level playing fields, when 12 four-legged contestants were disqualified from a camel beauty contest in Saudi Arabia for using Botox. A camel breeder explained that Botox is used to exaggerate the camel's lips, nose, and jaw so that judges say, oh, look how big that head is. And it was a good week for Senator Tammy Duckworth after the Illinois Democrat, 49, announced she is expecting her second child, which will make her the first sitting senator to give birth. Duckworth, who lost both legs while serving in Iraq, conceived through in vitro fertilization. But it was a bad week for David Icke, Hawaii's governor, 61, who confessed he was unable to correct the state's erroneous warning of an imminent missile attack for 17 minutes because he'd forgotten his Twitter password. It was a bad week for eating raw salmon when a California man with a daily sushi habit discovered during a bowel movement that he had acquired a tapeworm from one of his lunches. He pulled and pulled, and the worm was 5 feet, 6 inches long. And finally, it was a bad week for rejoining the herd after police blocked Chris Christie from using a VIP entrance at Newark Airport that he'd used for 8 years as New Jersey's governor and directed him to stand in TSA screening lines like everyone else. Christie later insisted he'd simply stood in the wrong line by mistake. And a couple of other items while we're on this page. The first spending bill gives Trump new intel powers. The White House can now direct U.S. intelligence agencies to spend money and launch covert actions without congressional oversight, thanks to a provision in the stopgap spending bill that ended the government shutdown this week. The last-minute provision exempts intelligence agencies from a decades-old law requiring them to inform congressional committees if they spend money on activities not expressly authorized by lawmakers. Senator Richard Burr, chair of the Senate Intelligence Committee, tried to strip the provision out of the spending bill, but was blocked. Burr and committee vice chair Senator Mark Warner said they would fight to remove the provision when the spending bill expires on February 8th. And an Only in America item, a man who tried to rob a California Starbucks is suing the customer who stopped him for using excessive force. Ryan Flores was threatening the cashier with a knife and fake gun when customer Craig Jerry hit him with a chair. Flores then stabbed Jerry in the neck, but Jerry seized the knife and stabbed Flores repeatedly. The guy, in my opinion, went from Good Samaritan to a vigilante, said Flores' mother. On the briefing page now, titled this week, The Steele Dossier. What role is a controversial intelligence report playing in the Russia investigation? What is the dossier? Compiled by a former British spy in 2016, it is a 35-page research document alleging that Donald Trump and his campaign team cooperated with Russia's efforts to help Trump win the presidential election. The dossier claims Moscow cultivated the businessman for at least 5 years and that he and his aides showed full knowledge and support of Russia's leaking of hacked Democratic National Committee emails. In return, the dossier alleges the Trump campaign promised to sideline Russian intervention in Ukraine as a campaign issue and to drop Russian sanctions if they won the election. The document names three Trump associates, campaign manager Paul Manafort, foreign advisor Carter Page, and personal lawyer Michael Cohen, as having corresponded with or met Russian officials to discuss this plan. And it makes the explosive and totally unverified claim that Moscow is blackmailing Trump. partly through its possession of a, quote, P-tape, a covert video supposedly showing Russian prostitutes following Trump's instructions to urinate on a bed once slept in by the Obamas at the Moscow Ritz-Carlton. Trump has dismissed the dossier as a pile of garbage. Who financed it? During the Republican primary in 2015, the conservative website Washington Free Beacon retained a D.C.-based research firm, Fusion GPS, to investigate Trump. Fusion's co-founder, former Wall Street Journal reporter Glenn Simpson, said what began as an open-ended examination of Trump's business record evolved somewhat quickly into issues of his relationships to organized crime figures. When the Free Beacon ceased its funding in spring 2016, a lawyer acting on behalf of Hillary Clinton's campaign and the DNC retained Fusion to continue its research. Simpson hired Christopher Steele, a former head of the Russia desk at MI6, Britain's foreign intelligence agency, to look into Trump's business relationships with Russia. Simpson described Steele, who is well-respected within the U.S. intelligence community, as a Boy Scout who doesn't sell baloney. What did Steele do? He worked his Russian sources, including a former top-level intelligence officer still active in the Kremlin and a senior Russian foreign ministry official. Steele sent Fusion his first memo on June 20th, but says he was so alarmed by the possibility of Russian blackmail of a U.S. presidential candidate that he notified the FBI. Steele also briefed journalists from several news outlets about his research, but none chose to publish the unverified allegations. Eventually, on October 31st, Mother Jones ran a story revealing the dossier's existence. After the election, Republican Senator John McCain sent an emissary to the UK to pick up a copy and then gave it to FBI Director James Comey. During the transition, intelligence officials briefed President Obama, congressional leaders, and President-elect Trump on the dossier's allegations. In January, BuzzFeed published the entire document online. How much of it is true? Special Counsel Robert Mueller's team has undoubtedly tried to find out, with unknown results. But publicly, at least, most of the dossier's specific allegations remain unverified. Cohen published photos of his passport to prove he wasn't in Prague meeting Russian officials in August, as the dossier claims. Though skeptics point out he did visit Italy in July and could have traveled within the EU to Prague for a secret Russian meeting without receiving a passport stamp. Page testified under oath that he hadn't met Igor Sekin, head of Rosneft, Russia's state oil company, but later admitted he had talked to other Rosneft officials. Many of the dossier's broader conclusions do appear accurate. There was a Russian effort to help Trump win the election. Trump associates did meet many Russian officials. And in his first week in office, Trump reportedly did order his staff to look into relieving the sanctions, a move blocked by Congress. Steele has acknowledged that the dossier consisted of raw intelligence, which is bound to contain factual errors, but he still believes it is 70 to 90% accurate. I've been dealing with Russia for 30 years, he says. Why would I invent this stuff? Why are Republicans skeptical? The president's defenders contend that since Democrats paid for Steele's dossier, it's politically motivated and tainted. They have speculated that the Obama administration and, quote, deep state officials hostile to Trump used this Oppo research to justify wiretaps of Trump officials and to launch the Russia investigation. In a leak that likely came from the FBI, the New York Times recently quoted sources saying that the investigation actually began because George Papadopoulos, a Trump foreign policy advisor, drunkenly told an Australian diplomat that Russia had hacked emails damaging to Hillary Clinton. Nonetheless, many GOP lawmakers have sought to discredit the dossier, and some even suggest Fusion was the victim of a Russian disinformation campaign. Simpson insists the truth is much simpler. We threw in a line in the water, he said, and Moby Dick came back. Time to read a few of the columns. We'll start with one from the U.S., the global impasse over immigration. Throughout the Western world, immigration is the most divisive issue of our times, said Walter Russell Mead. Anger over a large influx of immigrants powered Donald Trump's triumph over the Republican and Democratic establishments while tipping the U.K. referendum toward Brexit. In Germany, Prime Minister Angela Merkel, once the unchallenged master of European politics, has been badly weakened by her decision to admit 1 million Middle Eastern and African immigrants and is now struggling to form a governing coalition. Why is immigration so radioactive? Educated elites and the business class strongly favor immigration on economic and moral grounds, but many working and middle-class voters believe that low-skilled immigrants depress wages, bring social problems, and siphon off public benefits. Their resentment has given rise to the right-wing populist movements throughout the West. Over time, the conflict over immigration will only grow as hundreds of millions of people from poor and chaotic countries in the Middle East, Africa, and Central America seek to migrate to North America and the European Union. To avoid an even bigger backlash, political leaders must find a middle ground between a naive open-door policy and ugly nativism. Without pragmatic reform, this fight will get far uglier. This comes from Latvia, at the mercy of online healthcare. Digitizing our health records was supposed to make Latvians' lives easier, said Renars Pontnins. But last week, a denial-of-service attack brought the entire country's healthcare system to a halt, leaving patients unable to fill prescriptions or book appointments. Such a vulnerability is simply inexcusable. Latvia spent nearly $18 million setting up the e-health system, and for our population of just 2 million people, smaller than many world cities, that should have been more than enough. What happened? Greed, corruption, incompetence, negligence. Even when e-health is running, the internet-based service is slow, and that slows down doctors. I know this firsthand because I'm not only a lawmaker at the national legislature, but also a neurosurgeon. Medical workers complained for months during the beta testing phase, but their concerns were never addressed. Doctors still drum their fingers as they wait for the software to load so they can enter a measurement or a test result. It's time for a total overhaul. There were a lot of players involved in creating this system. Every one of them needs to be tracked down and held accountable, including financially, so we can implement a better design. Latvians can't entrust their health to a system that has to be restarted every time the sun rises in China and people start mining for bitcoins. And from South Africa, panicking as the taps run dry. Cape Town has the potential to devolve into a bloody, roaring, dystopian nightmare, said Tom Eaton. After 3 years of what has been billed a once-in-a-millennium drought, but is probably the new normal, this city of 4 million people is almost out of water. Authorities say that on April 12th, they will likely have to turn off the taps, and extreme water rationing will begin. Frantic drilling of wells and the construction of desalination plants has begun, or is at least planned, but no new water will be available for months. It's going to be hell. We Cape Tonians have already been urged to limit water use, but 60% have failed to do so, proving that you don't have to be in the 1% to be 100% entitled. City leaders are no help at all, blaming national and provincial authorities for the predicament rather than offering leadership and inspiration. Panic is setting in. We're all floating, helpless and anxious, gravitating toward anyone who knows anything even faintly official or scientific. So far, just 200 water distribution centers have been planned, which works out to about 20,000 people per center. The lines will be horrific. We need a better plan, and soon. Time, like baths, is a luxury we can no longer afford. It's time for the last word feature this week, titled "Where the Arctic is Vanishing." By mid-century, perennial ice in the Arctic is expected to dwindle to a strip above Greenland and Canada, said journalist Tim Folger. There, polar bears and other Arctic creatures will make a last stand for survival. We see evidence of the kill first, a shockingly broad spread of scarlet, probably the blood of a ringed seal on snow-covered sea ice. Then the polar bear appears. She's big, maybe 500 pounds, trailed by a single cub. They've just jumped into a lead, a long fissure of open water in the frozen sea. In seconds, they're out of the water again, running across the ice, spooked by the approach of our helicopter. Prolonged running can harm polar bears. Fat and fur insulate them so well that they risk overheating. Francois Latineau-Cloutier, our 33-year-old Quebecois pilot, takes us higher, and the mother and cub slow to an amble. After following them for several minutes, Latineau-Cloutier sets the helicopter gently onto the ice a few hundred feet away and cuts the engine. The mother rises on her hind legs, assessing our 35-foot-long flying machine with the unruffled gaze of the Arctic's top predator. The cub remains on all fours behind her. For a few timeless moments, we savor the scene. Bears against an otherwise empty immensity of snow and ice. Countless shallow pools of meltwater reflecting a high summer sun, ringed by faint halos of red and blue. Then, with a frenzied whine, the helicopter's rotor blades break the spell, and we lift off, veering southwest toward the campsite on the northernmost tip of Baffin Island, Canada, about 700 miles north of Hudson Bay. Within a few decades, such visits are unlikely to exist, at least not here, during summer. As the planet heats up, the summer sea ice and all the superbly adapted life it supports, the bears, the seals, the walrus, the whales, the Arctic cod, the crustaceans, the ice algae, may well vanish around Baffin. As we fly over the vast frozen expanse, it almost strains belief to think that we're witnessing, and with the rest of humanity helping to cause, its demise. In the 1980s, satellite data showed that Arctic sea ice extended on average across nearly 3 million square miles at the end of summer. Since then, more than 1 million square miles have been lost, an area roughly the size of Alaska, Texas, and California combined. Climate models suggest that by the 2050s, less than 200,000 square miles of perennial sea ice will remain. The good news, such as it is, what's left will collect in a compact region, not here but farther north, above Greenland and Canada's Ellesmere Island. The shrunken redoubt will be the last stand for many of Arctic's wild things. The animals that depend on the edge of the sea ice for a living will be congregating there in the summer, says marine ecologist Enric Sala, leader of the National Geographic Society's Pristine Seas Project. It will be like one of those watering holes in Africa where everybody shows up. Sala has come to Baffin with divers and filmmakers to document the icy world that's doomed here and to make the case for preserving the last ice farther north. Since he started Pristine Seas a decade ago, the project has helped protect more than 3 million square miles of ocean. But preserving the remnants of Arctic ice, which will require the cooperation of Greenland and Canada, will be the most ambitious undertaking. It's also the most urgent. The Arctic is changing faster than anything else, Sala says. And as the ice goes away, shipping, fishing, and oil and gas development may intrude. If sea ice and its denizens are to be protected, it must happen before exploitation of Arctic resources becomes unstoppable. With the last ice project, Sala says, we're looking 25 years ahead. In satellite photos, and perhaps in our imaginations, the icecape glazing the top of our world appears static, like a featureless white continent, permanent and immobile. Actually, it's a jostling mass of ice flows that, propelled by winds and currents, drift from one side of the Arctic to the other in journeys lasting years. People don't understand the Arctic, says Stephanie Furman, an oceanographer at Barnard College and Columbia University. They think of it as an ice cap. They think that it's rigid, and then when it melts, it's just melting back on the edges. They don't think of this dynamic aspect of it. In 2010, Furman was part of a team that identified the most likely location for the Arctic's last summer sea ice, work that has helped guide the Pristine Seas effort. Comparing a variety of computer models and satellite data, she and her colleagues found that winds and currents conspire to funnel drifting sea ice from all over the Arctic onto the northern edges of Greenland and the Canadian Arctic Archipelago, a region of spectacular fjords and more than 36,000 islands, including Ellesmere and Baffin. Year after year, massive ice flows stack up in that relatively calm zone. Some of the ice there is decades old and more than 80 feet thick. Furman and her colleagues realized that by mid-century, this frigid haven would hold the Arctic's only year-round ice. Their discovery was far from obvious. In some earlier climate models, Furman says, the Arctic's ice cover simply retreated evenly along the southern flank as the planet warmed, ultimately settling right around the North Pole. That makes no sense at all, though, she says. There's no reason for ice to congregate at the North Pole. It's going to keep moving until it hits something. Despite the steep decline in store over the next several decades, a long, narrow band of perennial ice will persist late into this century. If we can end our reliance on planet-heating fossil fuels, it could survive even longer, into a time when, just maybe, we'll figure out how to remove enough carbon from the atmosphere to cool the planet again. The ice models don't drop down to zero, Furman says. Some people say it's hopeless because we're on a trajectory where ice is going to be lost. But if you look at the climate models, it drops down precipitously, and then it has this long tail, which gives us some time to act and potentially mitigate the warming. The ice that does remain in the Arctic may provide a stable environment, albeit a compact one, for organisms that depend on ice. For people concerned about habitats, it's not that you will sometimes have the summer ice off the coast of Siberia and sometimes have the ice in the Beaufort Sea, Furman says, because you couldn't sustain a habitat if that ice was moving all around. It's actually pretty consistently going to be banked up off coastlines of Greenland and Canada. This is a newcomer, says Theo Ikumak, pointing to a delicate green shoot on the rocky beach near our campsite. Ikumak, a 60-year-old native of Igloolik, an island off Baffin, is a guide and advisor for our expedition. It's a cold and foggy June afternoon. The inlet we're walking along is still frozen. Ikumak carries a rifle over his shoulder in case we need to scare away polar bears. We've already spotted the tracks of one in the sand only a few hundred yards from our camp. The little green shoot, maybe a couple of inches high, has no name in the Inuit dialect spoken in this part of the Arctic. Ikumak doesn't recognize it. He knows only that it's another example of how the land and life are changing here. During our walk, we've passed what Ikumak says are new features in the landscape, large circular sinkholes created by thawing permafrost. Later that day, in the big tent where we have our meals, Ikumak tells me the names for a few Arctic animals. An Arluk kills everything, is a killer whale, a Tingulituk, bad liver don't eat, is a horned lark. But some animals, such as robins, are so new to the Arctic that Ikumak, at least, don't know names for them. With global warming, plant and animal species from the south have started to move north. It's a trend that will only accelerate, says Brendan Kelly, a biologist at the University of Alaska Fairbanks. As the habitat for Arctic wildlife shrinks, the animals that survive are likely to undergo profound changes. Diverse species will be thrust into closer contact than ever before. There's the potential for a massive scrambling of genes in the whole Arctic Ocean, Kelly says. We did a survey of marine mammals and came up with 34 species that are capable of hybridizing. For some reasons that scientists don't yet understand, marine mammals have tended to retain the same number of chromosomes, a key requirement for hybridization, as they diverged into different species and even genera. So you end up with things that you would otherwise say are different genera, but are in fact able to produce fertile hybrid offspring, said Kelly. An example would be harp seals and hooded seals, which we classify as different genera. But we've seen them hybridize in the wild. There is some evidence of a hybrid between belugas and narwhals. Pizzlies, crosses of grizzlies and polar bears, already roam the Arctic. Genetic studies showed that polar bears began diverging from grizzly bears within the past 500,000 years. Global warming threatens to reunite the two species. We could lose polar bears, Kelly says. They might be reabsorbed into the grizzly bear genome out of which they came. We're not just talking about ecological change. We're talking about evolutionary change, really sped up. The end result, says Kelly, is likely to be a tremendous, irreversible loss of genetic diversity. But even if that weren't the case, the Arctic's wildlife would still be in trouble. We're changing the habitat so fast that even if they have the genetic diversity to respond, they may not have the time. For some of the world's iconic species, the last ice region could make the difference between survival and extinction. Peaceful, isn't it? Henrik Sala is smiling as he joins me on the beach in front of our camp's double row of two dozen orange tents. We're looking east across the frozen reaches of Navy Board Inlet toward Bylot Island, several miles away. Covered with mountains and glaciers, a refuge for denning polar bears and hundreds of thousands of nesting birds, it's larger than the big island of Hawaii. After more than a week of waiting, Sala and his team of divers are eager to explore some open water around a couple of small islands off Bylot's western shore. In a few weeks, algae will be in full bloom, the water will cloud, and underwater filming opportunities will vanish. But now the sea is just beginning to blaze with light. Sunlight is like a lighter for this ecosystem. It's why we're here now, says Manu San Felix, a diver and photographer who has joined us on the beach wearing his dry suit. Over the next few days, if the weather holds, he, Sala, and other expedition members will record the beauty of what will be lost if we fail to protect the Arctic's last ice. The harder work, more arduous even than diving in freezing water, will take years, persuading governments to cooperate to save a region that extends across borders. Preserving the last ice region itself won't be enough. Because ice migrates long distances, its sources will have to be protected, too. Right now, for example, Siberian ice contaminated with nickel and lead from the Russian industrial city of Norilsk, one of the world's most polluted places, sometimes drifts into the Canadian Arctic. There it poisons the food web as it melts. It's a good sign that we are seeing narwhals, belugas, and polar bears, said San Felix. It means the food chain here is still healthy. We talk about a pod of bowhead whales that were spotted during a helicopter flight the other day, and about how their huge heads enable them to smash through 2 feet of ice. Bowheads can live 200 years or more. One way their age has been determined is by carbon dating old harpoon points embedded in their bodies. The oldest of them now, says San Felix, might have been born when Napoleon was still alive. Imagine, he says, that calf we filmed might be here in 2215. If we're lucky, that is, and foresighted enough, says Sala, this is not a simple linear story where we know how it ends. This was excerpted from an article that originally appeared in National Geographic. And speaking of water, we have an article on the Health and Science page called A New Source of Clean Water on Mars. Scientists have discovered massive sheets of ice buried mere feet beneath Mars' dusty surface, a source of water that could prove crucial for future human outposts on the red planet. It's been known for some time that as much as a third of the Martian surface contains shallow ice. But important details about that frozen water, its thickness, how pure it is, remained a mystery. To get that information, a team of researchers studied images captured by NASA's Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter of 8 steep slopes on the planet's mid-latitudes where erosion has exposed banded underground layers of ice and rock. Some of the ice deposits start a few feet beneath the surface, but extend more than 330 feet deep. And that ice, which likely started out as snow that fell tens of millions of years ago when Mars was wetter than it is today, appears to be relatively clean, reports SmithsonianMag.com. The revelation is a game-changer for any manned mission to Mars, study author Shane Brine says. Astronauts could essentially just go there with a bucket and a shovel and get all the water they need. The water could be used for drinking or farming or combined with carbon dioxide, the main component of Mars' atmosphere, to make oxygen and methane, a rocket fuel. The health scare of the week: how salt hurts the brain. A high salt diet can lead to significant mental decline, according to new research. Scientists at Weill Cornell Medicine in New York City fed mice 8 to 16 times their normal salt intake, and within 8 weeks observed a dramatic drop in blood flow to the cortex and the hippocampus, two regions of the brain associated with memory and learning. After 3 months, the mice were suffering from cognitive decline and struggled to navigate a maze and respond normally to stimulation. High salt diets are known to increase blood pressure, impairing the flow of blood to the brain. But even mice with normal blood pressure experience these changes in brain function, said the Los Angeles Times. Upon closer examination, the researchers found excessive salt intake triggered an immune response in the rodent's small intestine, which increased levels of the pro-inflammatory protein interleukin 17. That, in turn, impaired the function of blood vessels in the mice's brains. The researchers believe their findings likely apply to people as well, but the harmful effects of salt can be reversed. The brain function of the mice was restored when they resumed a healthy diet. And we're on the Talking Points page. First, we'll read an article called March for Life, A Growing Optimism. 45 years after Roe v. Wade, abortion opponents feel they may finally be on the verge of a breakthrough, said Andrew Egger in WeeklyStandard.com. This week, President Trump became the first sitting president to directly address the March for Life, which draws tens of thousands of pro-life protesters to Washington, D.C. every year. Under my administration, we will always defend the very first right in the Declaration of the Independence, Trump said by a video to rapturous applause, and that is the right to life. Abortion foes only reluctantly backed Trump, a New York libertine who once described himself as very pro-choice, said Philip Wegman in WashingtonExaminer.com. Their gamble has paid off. He appointed pro-life conservative Neil Gorsuch to the Supreme Court, reinstated the Mexico City policy barring U.S. international aid from funding abortions, and made it easier for states to keep their Medicaid funding from going to Planned Parenthood. In fact, Trump may go down in history as the most pro-life president ever. Most Americans, however, are at odds with the latest Oval Office occupant on the issue of abortion, said Eugene Scott in the Washington Post. A clear majority, 58%, believe that abortion should be legal in all or most cases, including 65% of 18 to 29-year-olds, according to a recent Pew Research Center polls. Trump has also failed to deliver on some of his biggest promises to the pro-life movement, including pushing through a nationwide ban on all abortions after 20 weeks and stripping Planned Parenthood of its federal funding. To do either, he'll have to overcome the fierce opposition of Americans who view the right to abortion as a fundamental right. Nevertheless, abortion foes have made significant progress, said Julie Robner in NPR.org. States have enacted more than 400 restrictions on abortion since Republicans took over a majority of state legislatures in 2011. Meanwhile, a handful of blue states have expanded abortion rights, including New York and Oregon, which now require private health insurance plans to cover the procedure free of charge to patients. Increasingly, the U.S. looks like two different countries when it comes to abortion, with liberal states increasing access and conservative states all but outlawing it. In other words, a nation that looks a lot like it did 45 years ago. And some shorter notes. After just 2 weeks on the shelves, Michael Wolff's White House tell-all, Fire and Fury, is on track to outpace President Trump's own bestseller, The Art of the Deal. Wolff's book is projected to soon reach 1.75 million in sales, while Trump's story of how he became rich and famous sold 1.67 million over three decades. More than 3.2 million Americans contributed to federal candidates in the 2016 elections, but 50% of the total funds came from just 0.5% of the contributors. U.S. crude oil production this year is set to exceed the output of Saudi Arabia for the first time in the modern era, largely thanks to the fracking revolution. output is expected to climb above 10.4 million barrels a day in 2018, topping the U.S. high set in 1970. Only Russia produces more at a rate of approximately 11 million barrels per day. Foreign tourism to the U.S. is declining as other nations come to see the U.S. as hostile to visitors. Tourist spending in the U.S. dropped 3.3% last year, the equivalent of $4.6 billion in losses and 40,000 jobs. Over on the poll watch, 49% of American voters blame President Donald Trump or the Republican Congress for the 15% for the recent government shutdown. 35% say the Democrats in Congress are to blame. 53% say the president has done enough to bring the two parties together. 81% think that founding fathers would be upset with the way institutions like the presidency and Congress have functioned over the past decade. And we've got enough time to finish with two quotes today. The first comes from writer Chuck Klosterman, quoted in the Minneapolis Star Tribune. He says, "If you want to avoid criticism, it's better to be good than it is to be great." And W.B. Yeats, quoted in the Newton, New Jersey Herald, says, "The world is full of magic things, patiently waiting for our senses to grow sharper." And with that, we have run out of time for today's episode of the week. I hope you've enjoyed it, and please be sure to listen again next time. This is Fred Woodward, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The Triangle Radio Reading Service thanks Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's Reading of the Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is available as a podcast at our website, TriangleReadingService.org. If you have any questions or comments, please give us a call, 919-832-5138. That's 919-832-5138.